Tune in. Again, this is Listen Local on Asheville FM. And now it's time for our interview with Steve Rasmussen. Steve is here in the studios at Asheville FM. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Steve, we invited you because you're very knowledgeable about the Downtown Master Plan. And can you let us know, first of all, how someone might recognize your name in the community and what are some things you've been known for in terms of both city politics and or just having been in our community for a long time?
Well, about a year ago last summer, I was camped out with my wife under the large magnolia tree in front of City Hall trying to prevent the Parkside condos from being built, and we were successful in that. I'm the High Priest of Coven Oldenwild, which is a Wiccan coven around here, and been here for 15 years, and of course, nature is sacred to us, and that's what motivated us to try to save the tree. But in the course of that, and also based on my 6 years as a journalist for Mountain Express, I was all too well aware of how difficult and corrupt our city development review process was. And Parkside, I think, illustrated that to everybody. It certainly changed city council elections and county commission before that. So, how I got into the Downtown Master Plan was that was being discussed at the time. Citizens were coming together and saying how they wanted to change things, and so were the developers and the city staff.
And what is the Downtown Master Plan?
It's intended to handle, rational way of handling development in the downtown area of Asheville, especially as more people theoretically move here. I mean, that was what was going on about a year ago, right before the recession hit. But people were increasingly concerned about the size of the buildings coming up, the ugliness of them, the kind of random way in which they were being approved. And again, developers too were very concerned. On the other side of the coin, about how arbitrary it seemed to be for getting their buildings approved. They didn't know what the rules were, and frankly nobody did, because that's the way it was.
Who are members of the Planning Commission? Are they just bureaucrats? Are they architects? Are they planners? Are they lay people?
Before we go there, actually, what's different about the Downtown Master Plan is that it pulls together many members of the community, in its formation and development, and as a plan on paper now, it grants some power to the Planning and Zoning Commission, which is an appointed body, and then some of that power and decision-making resides with City Council. But to take one step back before we get into the nitty-gritty of the Downtown Master Plan, another aspect of the Downtown Master Plan and the community's desire to have it is because for other areas in the community, we have the UDO, the Unified Development Ordinance. And for downtown, we have the Central Business District. And the CBD currently has no restriction on the height of buildings. And therefore, everyone in the community would benefit from having a plan on paper, which gives us guidelines, if not very particular rules, about what can be developed here. So it's a more particular form of zoning, and zoning has been the standard in the city of Asheville for many years. But the Downtown Master Plan is an opportunity for developers and community members to both know what we can do and also have ways of achieving our goals, such as affordable housing. And there are incentives for affordable housing in the Downtown Master Plan, just as there are incentives for affordable housing in some other types of development, such as the Neighborhood Corridor Districts 1 and 2. So a lot came before in Asheville, before Downtown Master Plan. We went through a UDO process in the 90s, and then that was adopted, and then there's been you could say nothing but trouble with the UDO. It probably served some people very well, but there are a lot of guidelines that are very much open to interpretation. So, Steve, catch us up in terms of the Downtown Master Plan. How does it exist now? Is it an adopted ordinance, and is it now the law of the land, or are we still tweaking it? What's going on?
Well, the City Council adopted the main master plan, the concept of it. But they specifically didn't adopt the appendices. Well, what they kind of worked out with the staff was that the appendices would be full of all the specific details, like exactly how much height are we going to allow downtown, you know, exactly what's the design of buildings that's acceptable going to be, that sort of thing. So that's what we're committees of volunteers together with city staff are working on right now, to get those appendices worked into ordinances, into city law.
And who are the people who get to sit on those committees who are going to, and clarify for us, do you get to make the decisions, or do you do the research and make the suggestions, which then city council needs to?
Yeah, it's us making suggestions, and then it's going to go to, I believe it's going to go to the downtown commission and the planning and zoning, but ultimately to city council, probably sometime around February or March. But who's on there is a good question. It's broken into about six different groups. One of them has to do with historic preservation. Another has to do with downtown district. That's a little bit controversial. But the one I got myself on has to do with urban design and development. And aside from me, it's all architects and developers. And there's a downtown business owner. There's city staff, but I'm really the only community citizen activist representative on that committee.
And actually, Steve, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the program is, for one reason, Listen Local wants to become a resource that our listeners can rely on for information about city, county, and even state and national government, and to be able to relate to our listeners of how these rules affect them, why it matters, what downtown master plan is adopted, why it matters, who serves on these commissions. But more particularly, you have done a lot of writing on what you call hot spots in the downtown master plan. Can you tell me a little bit about, first of all, where a listener can, after this program ends, read your writing and or follow up on this topic?
Well, they can follow up on the topic. Probably the best place to go would be my website, which is oldenwild.org, oldenwild.org. And for now, since everything's still very much in flux, you know, they can contact me. I'm not really publishing these things I'm writing widely. It's mostly to to city council, to other people that are interested. But certainly, anybody who wants to know more I can send it to them. There are two things, though, they do need to know about. One of them is that they can go on the city website, ashevillenc.gov/downtownmasterplan, and read the downtown master plan and the appendices. But more importantly, I think, is what I think we want to talk about here a little bit, which is what do people need to know before this goes up to city council? It's going to be pretty controversial. There's some major developers around here that were really happy with the way things used to be, where it was just pretty laissez-faire, and they've already kicked up a fuss about it, and they're going to fight hard to ensure that a lot of these really progressive provisions in this master plan are weakened or stopped.
And forgive me for being a cynical journalist, but is the group that you're part of and the people that are talking about it, is that just a debating society? Or will people really listen to this? And if the city council doesn't listen, do you have ways of pressuring them and making sure that the voice of the people is heard?
Well, I think this city council is going to listen too. Its members were elected because of this. Because of this whole master plan and the Parkside scandal. It's Gordon Smith, Cecil Bothwell, and Esther Mannheimer, too, is a really strong advocate of the master plan. So they're going to listen. I think the main concern is just really understanding it, and that's for everybody, too. It's a very, especially the part I'm involved with, it's very complex. And what I'm hoping to do in the next few minutes is kind of break it down a little for people. These are the key points. These are what you really need to listen for.
Take it away. That's why we have you here tonight, because in reading your writings, I saw that you were able to break it down into some jargon and give it some meaning so people understand when they hear shadowing what it means and what they want to look for and listen for, and also some hot spots that you identified that if you were to read the Downtown Master Plan, you would be reading from now until Christmas. So it might be helpful to have kind of some cliff notes on what are some hot spots. So Steve, if you could, in whatever order you'd like, tell us some information that will make it easier to understand what's going on in this downtown master plan and what we can look at to start getting a grasp on this document.
Okay, I think what I'll do is go through the six key, I think they call them
mechanisms
of control. That's right, yeah, this is all in planning speak, so it has to be translated. But these are like the key skeletal, you know, structure of the master plan as far as design and development goes. It's on page 80 and 81 of the master plan, and you wouldn't know it unless somebody pointed it out to you, but it's a really brilliantly engineered plan of the way all these six things work together, and the way everything that's in the master plan that has to do with building massing and so forth.
When we talk about building massing, we're talking about...
There's a planning term. All right, here's what building massing is. I was watching a news show on Sunday, and they had, you know, the talking head against the background of, like, Chicago's. And you look at a place like Chicago, it's got massive, giant buildings that go straight up from the ground and don't stop. You know, the classic skyscraper. Well, that's...
It's a width and height.
It's width and height. It's mass. It's like, you know, it's like a planet. It's the bigger it is, the more mass it's got. And what we're trying to do in the master plan is... lessen that, you know, in other words, handle more people coming in without turning it into Chicago or Charlotte or any place like that. And that's really what these six points are geared toward doing. So,
when we talk about what could be considered negative about massing, imagine a building that takes up an entire city block on all four sides. And so opponents to that mass of a building would say that decreases pedestrian interest in the street. If you remember the Wachovia building, currently they've put in some windows on the kind of west and north facing wall, making it a little bit more pedestrian friendly. But that was long a corridor where you had a mass of building which would invite you to not walk down that street. There were no eyes on you while you were walking, etc. So I just want to identify for people. You know, massing is not necessarily bad if you're talking about a national monument, but if you're talking about having a livable city where people feel safe and comfortable walking, biking, and interacting throughout the city, that's when massing becomes a problem.
That's exactly right, and that's what this is all geared toward fundamentally, is making this city a great place for pedestrians, because pedestrians are the ones that are going to frequent the shops, they're going to be walking around to the place where they live, that sort of thing. These consultants who came here from Boston were really struck by how vibrant Asheville street life is, and that's what they heard from the public, too. That's what we really value about this city. What we also really value about it is our place in the mountains, our nature, you know, our ability to just look up and see mountains, even though we're in the middle of downtown. So that's another thing that would be lost if you just had nothing but giant cubes filling downtown like you do in a place like Charlotte, for instance. So so if you can imagine, before I read these six things, let me draw a little picture for you real quick. Imagine the boxes under your Christmas tree. And just, take one of the bigger boxes, the ones that all the kids want to know what's in it. You know, it's a big doll maybe, no batteries included. And lay that box down. Maybe it's about 10 inches high. Well, then grab one of the boxes that has a shirt in it. It's a little smaller, a little flatter. Lay that on top of the doll box. And finally, grab a shoe box and stand it up on its end on top of that shirt box. And if you can get all that to stand up, then you can get an idea of what kind of the archetypal master plan building would look like. It's not a giant cube. It's kind of it's stepped back. It's narrowed. It's slender as it goes up. And that way, it helps preserve the view. It helps let sunlight into the street area. It doesn't look so intimidating as you're walking past it, and it's just a little more attractive than something like the BB&T building. So really, all these requirements are kind of geared around that fundamental shape. basically, I'll run through these as quick as I can and translate them up. Step A, and they do these in order, that you're going to be looking at a building at in order to approve it. Create gradual scale transitions to adjacent neighborhoods. So that's something called a context transition edge. What that means is if you're in an area that's right next to a neighborhood, you can't build more than two stories, basically. You can only have the doll box. You can't have those other box stuff.
And that's so that there's a contextual relationship between what's to your right, what's to your left, what's in front of you, what's behind you immediately.
Well, and especially the context that you're next to a neighborhood where people are living and don't want to be, you know, have this giant building necessarily next to them.
We're going
to
take a short break. It's coming up on 7 o'clock. We're just going to make a couple of technical changes in the next few moments. We're going to be right back. Stay tuned for Listen Local. We're going to continue this interview with Steve Rasmussen. Welcome back to Listen Local here on Asheville FM. We're going to move into the second half hour of the program. Thank you for letting us pause there to do a little technical thing here in the studio so we can ensure that later on we will be able to take your calls. We're going to return to a conversation with Steve Rasmussen, who is talking about the downtown master plan. Sorry to have interrupted you midstream there. We just talked about scale, and then we were talking about the context of buildings and their relationship to surrounding communities and neighborhoods, such as a residential district.
Yeah, and there's already been a little controversy about that. Montford found out that the Height District, which I'm about to describe in a minute, that extended into their neighborhood in the master plan, well, extended in their neighborhood and allowed high-rises to be built there in Montford, of all places.
Which is
historic.
Historic district.
Yeah. So they were rather upset and let the city staff know about it. And as soon as they found out, the staff said, we'll draw that back. And so it's been pulled, that zone has been pulled back to I-240 so that, you know, you don't get high rises in Montford. But that's it's an important thing. And that's part of this whole idea behind the master plan is that you're not going to have these abrupt, giant, monster buildings. Is like that. And now the second one of these key steps I was talking about is this is very controversial. This is a hot spot for sure. The height zones. The city's downtown is divided by the master plan into these intermediate height zone versus, I forget what it's called, tallest height zone. In this intermediate zone, you can build a building up to, right now it's set at 145 feet tall. In the taller height zone, it would be up to 265 feet tall. It's not huge. I mean, the county courthouse is 230 feet high, so it's not, the tallest one isn't a whole lot bigger than that. What's controversial about it is that a lot of developers don't want any height limits at all. They say that's a taking, that they're having their property seized by not being able to build up infinitely into the sky, basically. But basically, that's kind of one of the things the plan does. And then other people on the other side say those may be too high, particularly in parts of, well, now here's the key part, particularly in the central core of downtown, which is the historic area everybody cares the most about. There is a really tall height zone in there right around Battery Park, right where this whole controversy about the what might go across from the Basilica has been going on.
So have those height limits been set in stone, or are they one of the items that your committee is looking at?
Well, we're not really looking at those numbers so much. I mean, we could, but I think those are really going to be discussed by city council more. That's probably going to come up a little more there. I haven't really made a huge issue out of it on the committee, because I think there's some more important things that are coming up that I'll describe that have to do with reducing the mass of these buildings. But here's something that we did agree on.
the way that the another hot spot is the way the approval process is going to work, and throw all this authority into the hands of the Downtown Commission and Planning and Zoning.
Now, what do you mean by all this authority? Please
okay,
explain.
Yeah. When a developer proposes a building, it's going to go before it. Well, suppose it's one of these intermediate height buildings, 145 feet. If it's under a certain limit, which is 175,000 square feet in the master plan, then it's going to go to the Downtown Commission to have its design reviewed, and then it's going to go to Planning and Zoning Commission to get its whole site plan reviewed, final review, and they'll have the final approval on it. There won't be any say by City Council on a building like that. So that's been a concern of a lot of us, that you've got these appointed commissions that are traditionally dominated by developers, I mean very dominated.
And this is actually reminiscent of a campaign platform of Esther Mannheimer, who said that she would like for there to be clear rules such that developers could bypass what is often described as the battle at City Council, whereas alternately, I know that some other newly elected members of City Council, both Cecil Bothwell and Gordon Smith, their platforms included that they did not want to do anything to reduce public participation or public say in these decisions. However, they both agreed that having better rules to begin with and having earlier information made available to the public to let them know this is important, get involved now. What's your feeling on how certain it is that the current City Council is going to allow that particular provision, that so-called intermediate, we're calling it tonight, intermediate size buildings will not have to go directly to council? As a definitely a public hearing, as kind of like the way it does with at projects prior to the Downtown Master Plan?
Well, I think the key is going to be for them and for everybody here is going to be the right to appeal an approval. Right now, the way it's set up, if a developer is turned down by planning and zoning for one of those buildings, he'd have the right to appeal it to City Council. And so what we need, and what I'm being told is probably legal in state law, is citizens' appeal, the ability. If they really screwed up that approval, if they really broke the Downtown Master Plan's rules, there needs to be a right for what the state law calls an aggrieved person, which is probably going to be somebody who's directly affected by that building, like a neighbor or something, to be able to appeal that to City Council. And in fact, the state law allows City Council to appeal to itself. They actually could appeal Planning and Zoning's decision to themselves and review it.
So are we now talking about something that you think would be nice to have in the Downtown Master Plan, or something that currently is a part of this idea of a appeal process for the public?
It needs to be clarified and put in there directly. It's a very gray area of state law but it's important and it needs to be explicitly stated. And now here's a really interesting compromise that we came up with in this. Actually, the city staff discovered that this was possible and we kind of agreed on this. It's something called conditional zoning, and this is a brand new, well, as of just maybe 4 or 5 years ago, brand new state law, which our own city attorney was involved in drafting.
It's Bob Ost.
Bob Ost, yeah. And it's still a little bit uncertain, a little bit uncontroversial, but basically what it would allow for the largest buildings in the middle of the downtown core, what they call level 3 buildings that are going to be, you know, the huge ones that are over 175,000 square feet, reach up to 265 feet high. That would go to City Council, and they would be allowed to object to that building based on something that's in the old UDO called the 7 conditions, where it's got to, you know, is the scale appropriate? Is there, are there existing historic or natural landmarks nearby that it's going to ruin, that sort of thing. So they'd be kind of able to oversee it and say, no way, this really doesn't fit. Like the Fraga, Tony Fraga building would have been. They use those conditions to turn it down. They'd still be able to do that under this. And what's more, they would be able to participate early on in discussions about these buildings. Right now, the way the UDO is set up, they're not allowed, and this is one of the things that's made it so crazy at those public hearings, is that because of the way state law was written, city council wasn't even allowed to hear anything about the proposal until 2 days before the hearing. And so, they didn't have any input on it. They just had to make a snap decision. And so this would change all that. It allowed them to get involved in talking to the developer right at the beginning of his proposal. And the public would really need to be involved, too. People need to go to these downtown commission meetings. They need to go to these planning and zoning meetings. And they're actually rather dramatic. I've worked out a deal with Mountain Express, where people can, including me, can record these meetings digitally and upload them, put them on their website. It's a feature called Citizen On Board, and haven't really hoped to really get it going a little more after the holidays. But that's the idea, is that people would be able to, if you can't go to the meeting, at least you can hear it on the internet.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to stop interrupting. I think we're talking about very important things. So I'm going to let you go through all the hot spots and the mechanisms of control, because there's so much to talk about. I keep taking you off tangent, but
believe me, you should see how these meetings go. We go off on a lot of tangents, but because it's very important stuff. Let me continue, and I'll try to be pretty concise. The third key control mechanism is shape building massing and height to prevent excessive shading of public parks, plazas, or landmark buildings. The key phrase there is shadowing or shadow impacts. And that's where you're trying to prevent shadows from being cast on parks to the extent that it keeps it in darkness. It takes out a lot of the park. It kills the grass. It's cold. It's unpleasant. And the same way with historic landmarks. Well, where this is really a hot spot is especially in regard to Parkside, because it's the shadowing rules that are currently in the master plan that are basically the only thing preventing a new Parkside proposal from being put forth.
Meaning a new proposal for a development that could cause shadowing on our new multi-million dollar public square.
Exactly, yeah. And I think the shadowing rules as they stand now are a little bit weak. They give a 50-foot free zone to the building that can cast a shadow all at once for 50 feet, which I think needs to be changed. But the rest of it is saying that it's very technical. At the equinox, for 2 hours either side of noon, they measure the shadowing, and if it casts a shadow past that 50-foot zone for more than 2 hours, then that building's too tall and it has to be scaled back. So that's shadowing, and that's a very controversial thing. Already one developer's complained mightily about it, and I've gotten into a big controversy about a little place called Grace's Garden that's over on the corner of Lexington and Patton, that landowner there says he wants the right to be able to build a huge building next to it that would shadow it. Well, it's a beautiful little park, just the kind of pocket park that our master plan's trying to recommend we keep and have more of, so the pedestrians have a place to sit when they're walking around and sun themselves when they're walking around downtown shopping. So anyway, I'm making a fuss about that. Let's make this a test case to protect this little park by whatever shadowing rules we end up with. The next thing after that is, the fourth thing, is to preserve downtown's traditional scale and allow daylight to reach street level. And the key phrase here is step backs. So if you go back to that image of the stacked Christmas boxes, what you would have with a building, a downtown master plan building, is you'd walk along and you'd see the wall up next to the street, they call it the street wall, would go up as high as the street is wide. So in other words, if the street's 50 feet wide, then that wall can't go up higher than 50 feet. That's to preserve the right scale. It would also, by the way, have a lot of windows in it. Nobody does wants any more of those blank walls like the Wachovia we're talking about. Secondly, though, once it could go up to 75 feet, and once it got, it would go up to 50 feet in that case. Say the street's 50 feet wide, the street wall goes up 50 feet, and then it would be like the top of that doll box. It would step back to the where the little clothing box is on top of it. You'd have a little like a little ledge, even a little garden, hanging garden up there or something. It wouldn't necessarily be on the front. It could be on the side, and you know the size depends on the rules. But basically, that step back is to to prevent these sheer walls, these concrete canyons from rising alongside our streets. So that's an important thing, and again, some developers object to that because the reason they build these giant square buildings is because they're building out to the max of their property, and they think that's going to make them the most money, and therefore anything that you take away from that is they consider as taking away from their private property rights. It's like, well, private property rights. If I built a house that went, 265 feet up and out to the very edge of my property in my neighborhood, I think my neighbors would have something to say about that. So that's pretty much what we're saying, is that we need to keep this pedestrian scale. The last two are... Well, first of all, create slender buildings that allow view corridors and daylight between them. And the key phrase here is floor plate restrictions. Now, remember, okay.
What's a floor plate?
What's a floor plate, yeah. Imagine that shoebox that you stood on end. Each of the floors, if that's a building, each of those floors in that, say, 5 or 6 or 8 stories in there, the floor plate is the size of that floor, the square footage of that floor. So the master plan is saying that floor plate, that size of that square footage, can be no more than 30% of the building property there. So in other words, it has to be slender. It's keeping it restricted. And the idea is to have buildings, say the consultants compared it to Vancouver, where they say there's a lot of really tall, slender buildings of this type that allow you to see the mountains around you and so forth. But where it also especially comes in is this last point, which says, clearly illustrate how the building will enhance the downtown skyline and preserve established public view corridors. What's a view corridor? That's a big topic. What they said was that you've got these valuable mountain views that you need to preserve, and here are some corridors we've mapped out that are the key views, like Mount Pisgah, Mount Mitchell, and so forth. But they couldn't figure out a way to enforce these corridors to make sure that somebody didn't build a building in the middle of it. Basically, what all they came up with was, well, you have to at least show what it's going to do to the view corridor. I believe that, that's a case where if it intrudes into that corridor, it needs to go to city council for further review. But we haven't gotten to that point in our discussions yet at the committee as we're working through these things. So, but that's going to be controversial too when people on citizens find out just how weak that requirement is, and when developers find out just how strong it is, or just how important it is, I should say.
Well, Steve, you've outlined the 6 so-called mechanisms of control of height and massing, and these are in the downtown master plan. And you mentioned they're on page like 80 and 81 of the downtown master plan. And they seem somewhat objective, somewhat subjective, but for instance, the language in that last one was, clearly illustrate how the building will enhance the downtown skyline and preserve established public view corridors. What are the conversations around clearly illustrate how the building will enhance the downtown skyline? Who, for instance, under the current downtown master plan, which you're on the committee, you're working on all the details, so not all the details are there, in the mind of the planners and the others who created this document, who makes that decision? That is a subjective decision, whether or not my argument for my building will enhance the downtown skyline.
Well, and there, actually rather excessively, in my view, focused on strictly objective criteria. If they can't measure it, then it doesn't, it can't be a requirement. And so since they haven't figured out a way how to
measure enhancement,
therefore they don't want that to be a requirement. They want it to be just a recommendation, which...
Who's they?
They being city staff, city planners, the downtown commission. It's really, it's city staff and the downtown commission that are mostly driving this, especially the downtown commission. It was, they were the ones who pushed for the master plan to begin with. And, you know, it kind of concerned me that they would also really expand their role in this review process, and it does tend to be dominated by architects and developers. People who are going to have to be recusing themselves quite a lot from voting if they're going to be honest, because they're going to have so many interests tied into this. And so that's why I've always had this suspicion that insisting on strictly objective criteria is really just kind of a way of making it kind of a clickety-click railroad that a developer can just zoom right through without anybody really having much of a say about, you know, well, that's still a darn ugly building and it still blocks our view. So I think, you know, that's one of the areas where, you know, I think that does, if it really, you know, we do need to talk about how can we, another area that's like that is building caps. The master plan says that a cap, a building has to have, instead of being just a block, a cube, you know, it's got to have a roof on it, some kind of a cap, some kind of a top, so you get an idea that it's like a human has a head, a building has to have a head, you know. It's just something psychological that we consider important as human beings, and as, you know, and not feel intimidated by a building. Well, and they say that the cap has to be of Asheville, characteristic of Asheville. So people are saying, well, what's that? What's of Asheville? You know, well, we can't define it, so let's take that out. And I've been arguing, no, you know, let's go around and take photographs of 25 or 30 really well-known Asheville buildings that have caps. Look at those photographs and see what kind of characteristics we can see in there. We can, you know, we probably can find a way that's maybe not purely objective scientifically, but at least everybody can see.
And we could certainly avoid what was put as the cap to Stuart Coleman's residential development on Battery Park, which has the heating and air conditioning unit on top, which is a blinding silver for anyone on those two sides of that building, where you expect to look downtown and you're trying to see the skyline and you're blinded by an HVAC system put on the top of a downtown building.
And under the master plan, those, that would have to be screened. Now, one thing about these height zones that people need to understand is that it's not just 145 feet. Or not just 265 feet. They also that's a measurement up to the top floor of the building, the top occupied floor. But they still get another 50 feet after that to put, like if they're building a ballroom up there, or if they're putting that kind of equipment up there. But they do have to screen it.
And that is something that all of our listeners should keep in mind when they hear about what a limitation is. If it's the building height, like you said, there's often up to 50 feet allowed for mechanical and engineering height. And when we talk about stories, if you do not define how much height is included in a story, a 27-story building can be as large as 50 feet if every story has 13 or 14-foot ceilings. So those details, I'm very glad, Steve, that you and others have volunteered to work on these details and to be advocates for defining what are we really saying when we're talking about 245 feet. When you look into the horizon, how high do you really have to look to see above that building?
And that, yeah, and that's really the key intent of this whole master plan, and that people have to hold all the officials' feet to the fire about is that it's to preserve what's special about Asheville. And, you know, that's our history and our nature. And it's not to, you know, just slap in a bunch of condos that look like they came from Miami and you know, are going to look like slums in a couple of years.
Well, Steve, we're going to have to wrap up, but I want to spend the next 5 minutes wrapping up by talking about where you are in the process of the Downtown Master Plan and the specific committee that you sit on. When is the next time that conversation about the Downtown Master Plan is going to come up for the public, and how you would encourage the public to stay involved. Obviously, the committees are already chosen, so I don't know that people can serve on committees. So let's just talk about what you're going to be doing next, what, as far as you know, the timeline currently, when is this next going to come up to the public as, here, we've done our work, please look at what we've done, and how can people stay involved? Because we need to remind listeners that the previous city council adopted the downtown master plan in theory, and now they're waiting on the details, but there is some issue with what development is going to go on before this is adopted. There's some pressure to go ahead and adopt something and have the details, because there can be protection in details, or there can be, depending on your opinion, harm in those details. So, Steve, what's next for you as a member of this committee?
Well, we our last meeting before the holidays was yesterday, so by the time we're breaking until January 13th, and probably all these details are going to disappear in a fog of eggnog between now and then, but hopefully we'll, we've been meeting weekly to try to get this through. The city council wants this part first because of that concern of protection, and we'll probably get it to, they'll probably review it probably not earlier than February or March. The other committees are meeting and moving ahead. They're basically, the public that wants to find out more, they can either contact Sasha Vertunsky at the through the city's website. Just go to that ashevillenc.gov/downtownmasterplan, and they'll get, there's an email they can write to. And you know, there should be some that's probably the best way. And you know, if they want to contact me to find out some more details, they can go to my website at Oldenwilde, OldenWilde.org, and contact me through there.
Well, I think it's great that the city has recognized that we need a downtown master plan, and that in theory something has been adopted, because I do think we need to have plans in place. And I'm glad that you're able to serve on this committee. You mentioned that you're the only person on your particular committee who does not draw a paycheck from development.
Yeah, that's right. Except, like I say, there's also a downtown store owner, but that's it. And so I felt that that's why I felt it was important to be there. They tried to talk me out of it at first. Oh, we're just going to be talking about floor plates and things. Oh, well, that's what I want to be there for. One other thing I should mention, the public could also go to meetings of the Downtown Commission and Planning and Zoning, because they're getting regular updates from, these are public meetings, they're getting regular updates about the progress of the master plan from the staff there. So you can go and listen and ask questions there.
Excellent. Steve, thank you. I hope that we can invite you back and perhaps plan and spend an entire hour, and I won't interrupt you next time, no matter how fascinating
useful.
It is. You've been listening to Listen Local, the news and information program for AshevilleFM.org. Since we have just a couple minutes, I'm going to give you the out and about for this week. If you're looking for fun things to do this weekend and beyond, the Santa Land Diaries are going to be at the Asheville Community Theater. That's this Thursday, tonight, December 17th through Saturday. You have a couple days to catch this. The Santa Land Diaries are going to be performed at 7:30 p.m. each night. Asheville Community Theater is located at 35 East Walnut Street. The Santa Land Diaries was written by David Sedaris, and it's starring Tom Chalmers. It's recommended for mature audiences only. Tickets are $15 per person. To find out more, go online, ashevilletheater.org. That's theater with an R-E on the end. Or you can call 828-254-1320. Also coming up this weekend, Highland Brewing Company is having its 15th anniversary party. Can you believe it's been around 15 years, Steve?
That's when I moved here.
They're having a party to celebrate this Friday, December 18th, from 4 to 8 p.m. at their location at 12 Old Charlotte Highway. There will be entertainment, including music by Funknastics, and the release of Highland's new Odd Asheville Vintage Ale. You can visit highlandbrewing.com for event details. This Friday, you can also join a fundraiser for Hope House, which is a long-term residence for victims of human trafficking. Their event is this Friday. Doors open at 6:30 with a show at 7 p.m. The location is the Orange Peel, so the live event with music by Addison Road, Rebecca J., and Ryan Larkins. Tickets are $15, and again, it's a fundraiser for Hope House. Tickets can be purchased purchase online at itickets.com. This Saturday, Josh Phillips Folk Festival and Laura Reed will be at the Orange Peel this Saturday, the 19th. More information at theorangepeel.net. A Swannanoa Solstice will be performed at Diana Wortham Theater on Sunday, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. this Sunday, December 20th. You can enjoy an evening of music, dance, and storytelling celebrating Southern Appalachia's Celtic roots. Ticket prices range from $35 for adults to $12 for children. Find out more at dwtheater.com, that's theater R-E, or give them a call at 828-257-4530. La Zoom is offering holiday rides. Wednesday, December 23rd through Sunday, the 27th, you can ride the La Zoom bus. It's a 90-minute holiday-themed comedy tour of Asheville. Call 828-225-6932 for more information or go online, lazoomtours.com. Again, that's it for this week. You've been listening to Listen Local, the news and information program of AshevilleFM.org. If you are interested in contributing to the news or if you have a story you'd like to see covered, please email us at news@AshevilleFM.org. We can also be contacted via our Facebook group. To find it, simply search for Listen Local on Facebook.